Hi everyone, welcome back to Project Unlaced. Today I have a very special guest. I'm joined by Rebecca McConville. Rebecca, how are you doing today?
I am doing great, but it feels like winter has come in. As you can tell, I'm wearing my sweater. We went jump from summer to winter.
Oh, interesting. I'm in California and it's so hot right now. We had a huge heat wave today. I'm in a t-shirt and shorts.
We'll enjoy it.
I guess we can start out with talking a little bit about your experience and what made you interested in nutrition, especially for athletes.
Mm-hmm. So during my college years, I played basketball, and I really hadn't been interested directly in nutrition until about my sophomore year. And I was like, man, these girls are good. They're fast. They're stronger. I'm going to have to up my game. And so I thought, maybe if I started paying attention a little bit more to what I'm eating, maybe doing a little bit of additional training, then I would get that competitive edge. And so at first, like many, I did get that performance boost. I started getting faster. My reaction time was quicker. But then, you know, if a little bit's good, maybe a lot's better. And so took a little too far and then started seeing some of the signs. I mean, at that point, that wasn't even called triad. But, you know, was struggling with anemia, was struggling with irritable bowel. Parts of my game was still the same, but other parts I could tell I was not feeling like myself. And so that led me to have a natural curiosity around why the beginning nutrition impacted one way, but all of a sudden I felt like I was getting the reverse effect, and eventually kind of got myself out of it, but it really took away from my college years. And I think that's why I have such a soft spot that I want people to be able to fully enjoy their sport and their teammates. I kind of drifted away from my teammates during that time. So my degree was in biology, and I thought I could branch off from there and just do nutrition, but actually I had to go back and get an undergrad. And so, got a second degree and then got in my master's in dietetic internship, but struggled at that time to find anything that was centered around athletes. So actually, like many, went into the clinical route, which was helpful because it helped me get a better understanding of like disease process and how organs function. And that, you know, athletes are human, so they're going to have human conditions as well. And then finally, the door opened for me to start doing some consulting with athletes. And then I was like, yep, this is where I thought I wanted to be. And this is definitely where I want to be. But it took me a while to find a full-time job. But I absolutely love what I do.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I'd love to know a little bit more about is and we'll talk about like more of the nutrition aspect later, but the difference between the female triad and REDS, because one of the things that I've seen a lot is, especially on the coaches training aspect, a lot of them are still educated on the female triad, which has been replaced obviously for many years with relative energy deficiency in sport. So I think it would be really helpful if you could maybe shed a little bit of light on what is the difference between them?
Absolutely. So the triad started with, just as it sounds, like the triad of amenorrhea, so the loss of three menstrual cycles or more, and then a weight change, so a weight loss. They actually coined it as weight loss, and then bone stress fractures, or I think it had two or more, or compromised bone density. And so, you know, as data came and there was more research, they realized, obviously, a big piece was that males were missing, and that a lot of times underfueling can manifest in more than just menstrual cycle and bone. And so that became more holistic. So truly the triad is supposed to be, REDS is supposed to be an extension of the triad to include that in there, because it does get confusing. That's still used in literature and research to this day. And so it would be nice if they could merge together, but that's outside of my scope of practice.
Yeah. And going back to your college years, you just talked a little bit about underfueling and maybe over exercising. What made you kind of flip that coin? Like, what helped you get out of that hole, for lack of a better word? Because I know I fell into a very similar trap, and I didn't ask for help until I essentially hit rock bottom and was hospitalized. So I'd love to know, like, what was your decision like to focus on nutrition in the right way?
I mean, I think honestly, my body kind of made the call when, you know, I'm 5'4", so I was a guard. I was very quick. I had great reaction time, and was very scrappy. And I can remember it very distinctly, going for a ball and getting thrown down on the court like a rag doll. And I was like, whoa, that is not like me. Like, I'm the one that's usually doing that. And so what started as a means to improve my performance, I realized was actually now causing me to perform worse. And I started having sleep issues, and I had a rib fracture that wasn't healing as it was supposed to. So there's kind of one thing after another, and then just slowly was kind of like, I'm tired of this. I actually, and I can't say that I had a unhealthy culture with coaches. One of my assistant coaches actually said, like, he actually asked me, did you get sick over the summer when I came back? And I was like, no, I've just been focused on my nutrition. He's like, I think you took it too far. So I was actually to hear that from a coach that had the before and after and could tell that that was showing up in my performance. I think that really struck me. And so from there, I mean, I kind of had a year of really not still connecting with my sport or my teammates, but eventually did pull out of it.
Yeah, I think that's so great that you did have a coach who did notice something and brought it up to you, because I think that's so lacking. I know that I've seen that very much lacking in my own experience with sports. I've been through multiple coaches, and I've never really had a very positive atmosphere around body image and nutrition. I'm in running, so it's especially a very toxic relationship around food often. So I think that's just so important that coaches are able to talk about these issues more often. And I guess one thing that I'd love to ask you is, like, what are some of the biggest misconceptions about nutrition that you think are around or that you had as a young athlete?
Again, I think I'm going to add a little different. I mean, I grew up on a farm. I grew up in an agriculture area. So, you know, we thrived off the food that was in that area. So there wasn't a whole lot of good food, bad food talk, but there also was no education. Like, it wasn't even brought up. So it was through our own natural curiosity. But again, I think I'm showing my age. There was no social media or anything like that as well. So I think what really ended up happening was, you know, when you leave people misguided and their symptoms pop in silos. So, you know, I went to the doctor for my irritable bowel and that was treated. And then I went to the doctor for the anemia and that was treated. And then nobody asked why the fracture, and when I say fracture, I took a direct contact that broke the rib. So it wasn't like a stress fracture. Nobody was asking why that wasn't healing. Had they kind of reflected and asked me what changes had been made, and that this all started when I started doing extra training and changing my nutrition, somebody may have said, like, it seems like your body is starting to struggle with heal. What have you done different with your nutrition? And now, I mean, they're inundated from every direction on what you should eat, how much you should eat, compare with your friends, look at this Pinterest, look at this TikTok video. And so that just naturally leads to your brain to compare and then try to figure out where you're going to be most safest at as an athlete and as a human.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these things even happen, like, subconsciously. Like, so many people don't realize, like, when they're scrolling on Instagram, that these are, like, potentially toxic messaging around nutrition and body image. I know that for me, like, whenever I see a what not eat in the day that starts with a body check, like, immediately that's for me, okay, I'm going to scroll past that. Like, I know that's not going to be helpful for me, because it's not true that even if, you know, first of all, they could be lying, for one thing. And second of all, even if we all ate the same, like, you know, our bodies are still going to look differently and they have different needs than me. So I like that you bring that up of, like, now I feel like young people are just bombarded. Not even young people, but it feels like everyone is just bombarded with constant messaging about culture.
And if you think about how the brain functions, its primal means is to protect, right? Like, tribal mentality, how can we make sure we're safe and secure? So as your brain is looking at varying messages, and the culture says, like, if you control what you eat, and if you look at your food labels, and if you do XYZ, and then all of a sudden you see an image on Instagram and you're like, oh, okay, there's a plate that this athlete's really well known. So therefore, if I can eat like them, I know I'll be safe and secure. And that's how that ends up clicking in without thinking rashly, like, wait a minute, what did they have for breakfast? What did they have for lunch? How do I know that they actually ate that? How do I know that plate's not magnified? So yeah, there's a lot of different variables that come into play.
Yeah. And I think this thing is so tough because, Like, what are the ways to get around that? And what are the ways to push through it? It's not like you can isolate yourself from that messaging. It's almost impossible to get away from. So what advice do you have for people who, like, are struggling with their relationship with food and comparing their food to other people and that, like, impulse to restrict food or be really strict about diet?
Yeah, so I always start out with, like, a simple question. Well, it's not simple because it requires a lot of reflection, is, do you know this to be true to you, right? So if they're thinking about, I need to cut this out, or I'm worried that it's going to slow my race times, well, have you tried it? Have you actually experimented with it, with eating more carb, or, you know, increasing the size of your meals? And so to get them to do that long term is difficult. So I usually say, okay, can you give me 2 or 3 days? Let's try 2 or 3 days of you doing this differently. And then let's see how you feel. And then I also lean into, like, what is it about that person or that particular trend that you're gravitating towards to compare? You brought up something, and I always bring this up in interviews, that people aren't necessarily authentic. So there's a lot of athletes, even professional ones, that are pushing products that I have had them say they don't even use themselves.
Yeah. And I guess, like, I mean, it's understandable, especially when they're pro athletes, like, trying to make a buck. But even, like, influencers, like, I mean, they make money off of putting, like, exaggerated things and getting clicks and getting likes. And I think I really like how you come from this from a very rational place. I also think I'm, like, a rational person. So do you think that comes from, like, your previous training in biology? You said that you did your degree in biology. Like, how do you think that's influenced how you think of nutrition and how you work with your athletes?
Well, I love that question. So part of it, that helps me be more solidified in science and evidence base, but also as a role of being an eating disorder specialist dietitian, you know, we look at psychology. I'm not trying to be a psychologist, but I have to understand how the brain functions and how that influences behaviors around food, movement, weight, body image, etc. And so kind of blending that in together, that's where I'm like, all right, yeah, it'd be natural for that to have a reaction when you're looking at something like that. But let's dig a little bit deeper and tell me how that then changes your next behavior. So, like, social media, I'll tell them, like, if you're struggling with that, I'm guilty, like, not guilty is not a right word. I struggle with that just like everybody else. If you get onto social media and all of a sudden you find that your mood is tanking, or you're just kind of going like this and you're looking for something to validate to your next step, that's probably not a healthy relationship. But if you're like, oh, I want to look at these cute little puppy yoga videos. Sorry, that's me. And they leave me in a better mood and smiling, then that's what social media should be intended for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And I love how you really, like, clearly break things down into steps as, like, this leads to this, and really trying to get to, like, what is the foundation? Like, not just can we stop these thoughts, but what's actually causing you to think these thoughts and, like, use these actions as, like, a coping mechanism. Yeah. So one thing about your work that I found really interesting is how you work with athletes from, like, all levels. And I was wondering, like, what are some similarities you see, but what are also some things about, like, working with elite and, like, high level collegiate athletes that might surprise people?
Yeah. So obviously, as athletes, we all have that competitive nature. So we want to do things to get better. And I think that's across the board, if it's a 10-year-old versus an 85-year-old master's athlete. Where things have a little bit more nuance, and I'm respectful of it, is exactly what you said. When we're dealing with a professional athlete and that is their livelihood, then I can understand why they're pushing the envelope, but it's the team around them that's there to say, like, all right, our goal is also to help you perform your best, but the health has to come first. And this is how they're gonna help you with that. I think the elites also have a little bit more resources at hand, so they have more watchful eyes. So statistically, they may be more at risk, but they also tend to not get as sick as an individual who doesn't have an athletic trainer looking at them all the time, or physicians running DEXA scans or blood work. And so those are ones that individuals like myself and the therapist or whoever probably has to take a little bit more of a medical liaison role. We're not trying to be the medical provider, but we may have to do more collaboration and trying to communicate with their primary care or sports med docs.
Yeah, I would love to dig into that a little bit because I think a lot of times the bodies of these elite athletes, whether it's a pro or collegiate athlete, becomes almost like a role model and like an inspiration for younger athletes of, oh, like to perform well, this is what my body needs to look like. And I love that you bring up the fact that like there is a lot of support around these like high level athletes so that they can do this. Like I think that's just so like I think I've struggled with that a lot, even looking at like people that I admire and being like, I want my body to look like that so that I can perform that way. I think what advice would you have for young athletes who are having similar thoughts?
Well, that goes back to your previous question. That's another thing is, if they're professional athletes, then they may have the time to train 20, 30 hours a week, and they have chefs and massage therapists and things like that, because that is their job. But if you're a student and you're a student that has friends that you still want to go out with, that you have to realize that you're not going to have the time to train. And just because somebody's body looks that way doesn't necessarily mean that's why they perform the way that they do, or that we can't have athletes of all shapes and sizes. I think, again, going back to the brain and a Brene and the brain and Brene Brown, I think, or was it, oh shoot, I might be getting my wrong author, was like, if you're looking for proof you're not enough, you'll always find it. But
That
the key
sounds
is
like
can't.
something Brene Brown would
Yeah.
say.
But if you're looking for proof that you're enough, like, then you found home, right? And I think that's the problem, is we tend to gravitate towards like, ooh, if I could tweak my body to look like that athlete, then maybe I'll get to that next level, when really it's patience, right? It's doing the little things like getting enough sleep and honoring rest days and the non-sexy stuff, right? Those are the things that matter.
Yeah, I think I'd love to know a little bit more about your work as a dietitian. I know that it's a field that I'm very interested in. So I'd love to know, like, what are the hardest parts about your job, but also like the most rewarding parts, especially since you're interacting with so many people?
Yeah, I'd say the hardest part is either A, when somebody is dealing with like an injury that's pulled them out of, maybe they have a major race coming on or event. And then the other thing too is, when it's hard, when you're the rational, go back to that, when the rational part of your brain is saying like, hey, you need to rest, you need to eat more, but then they have this constant chatter on the other side that's saying like, but you might gain a bunch of weight, or you may never get back to it. And so they're in that tug of war that's exhausting, in being able to get them to trust the process and take it one day at a time. But on the flip side, what's really cool is when they see their bodies be able to do things they never thought possible. So recently, I had the pleasure, somebody I've worked with now for 2.5 years, and I remember it clearly, where she's like, am I ever going to be able to run again? Because she had had like stress fracture after fracture. And I said, I don't know, but we're sure going to do everything we can to see if you're able to. And I was like, it's not going to be tomorrow, but let's just break this down, a week, a month at a time. And then this past month, she completed her first 100-miler. And
Oh my
so just,
gosh.
yes, just, I still get goosebumps. Just the process that she had to go through to get there, and this excitement and joy that she could do it, and just every painstaking step of that 100-miler was just breathtaking, like, to hear her talk about it. So those are the things I love. And then also, like, when people, I remember I had a client that thought she'd never be able to have babies, and I get Christmas cards, and every time there's another baby on the Christmas card. So I'm like,
I love
she
that.
must
And
be
I think
doing good.
something that you said that made me think back to a quote that I saw that you really loved is the journey of a million miles begins with a single step. And I love that so much. And I even like wrote that down to me. And I thought that was a really like great point because I think so many of these things can seem so overwhelming. I know that I struggled with an eating disorder, anorexia nervosa. And at the start of your journey, it just seems so overwhelming. I'm like, how am I supposed to get from this dark place to a place where I can eat intuitively and exercise with a healthy relationship? And I think like breaking that down into little steps of, okay, I'm going to challenge this fear food. I'm going to, do this thing to increase my food intake so that I can gain weight back. I think like breaking it down into steps is just so powerful.
Oh, well, thank you for reading that. Yes, I actually have a coaster that has that in my office, so that way people see that as well.
Yeah, and I also love what you said about like the rational and irrational thoughts, because I've definitely felt that too, where I feel like I could talk about my eating disorder so rationally be like, yeah, of course I know that I have to keep gaining weight because I don't have my period. And, you know, of course I shouldn't be scared about, you know, this piece of bread or bagel or whatever. And then when it comes time to actually do those things and you're confronted with that, or you're confronted with a triggering post on Instagram or a triggering comment from a teammate, it can be so easy to like fall down that trap again. So like what are ways that athletes can almost create like a barrier to overcome those like thoughts, impulsive thoughts that come up mm-hmm. in the moment?
Yep. So they can almost have the rebuttal. Like if they know, and that's what I always say, like disordered thoughts are cookie cutter, meaning that we can have 10 people lined up and we're all 10 different individuals, but those thoughts will be the same. And so we're like, wait, we don't all think the same. So we must be getting those thoughts from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so it goes back again, you know, I love the brain and the neuropsychology piece of it. When we use strong fear language, it's kind of like that, like, don't touch the stove. What do we all do? Like, right? We got to just like lean over and see if it's hot. So then if we're thinking like, okay, I know I should have the bread. And then the next thing you know, we see something like bread's bad for you. Watch out. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, wait, maybe I shouldn't do that. And then that's all you can think of when you know your rational brain is like, bread is perfectly fine. Like I know as an athlete, I know as a human being, I need carbohydrates. And so looking for the fear language that's used and trying to steer clear of that, but then always having your rebuttal when you have those disordered thoughts can be helpful.
Yeah, I definitely found that really helpful in my recovery. I remember in my recovery, I would have like little cards at the dinner table and stuff so that when those, because you're right, those thoughts are so predictable. So it's really easy then if I had those thoughts, I would open up this card and I would be like, okay, like, I wrote this, I know that this is real, and I'm going to set this down, and now I'm going to, like, do whatever that challenge is for me. So I think that's, like, a really good way of, like, constantly reminding yourself, like, this is what's actually true, and, like, these are my actual goals, not my eating disorder, or not this voice that tells me I need to underfuel.
Yeah, and when the irrational part of the brain is in, so, you're like, you've got the primal part right here, and then the middle part is the one that can actually have memories. And so sometimes too, that's what's helpful for me is I'll be like, well, remember me that one time, you know, you were fearful of the bread and then you went and had a bagel with peanut butter and you went out and crushed it and had a PR. And so, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I can't believe I forgot about that. Like I shouldn't have fear over it. And so the cards can, I love that idea. The cards can also be helpful because you can attach a memory to it that had a positive outcome. So in that moment, you're like, I've done this. I do know this to be true for me because I've done it.
Yeah, no, I love that. So another thing that I saw you do on top of everything else is workshops on like relative energy deficiency in sport and eating disorders. So I'd love to know more of how coaches and parents can help support athletes in these situations, because I think it is really difficult. I know my parents have talked about this a lot, like seeing your daughter or your athlete clearly going through something, but not knowing how to approach it, especially when eating disorders are often very manipulative and defensive. Like they don't want to go away. So I'd love to know like what you think a coach and parent's role should be in supporting the athlete.
Yeah. I mean, what a fantastic question. So in that, I think with going back to those cards, I actually think we need somebody to make those for coaches. I feel like coaches get demonized. And like in my situation, again, if a coach hadn't brought that up to me, it wouldn't have kind of like made me pause. And because they don't know what to say, they avoid it or they misstep and say something they probably shouldn't that had good intention. Now, granted, I'm not dismissing. There's always a coach or two out there that are going to be very harmful and abusive, to be honest. And so I think what would be helpful is to have like, if you notice a concern, always tie it back to performance and health and be like, hey, you know what? Normally at the end of practice, you're talkative, you seem full of energy, but lately you just kind of go get your stuff and leave. what's going on? Are you getting enough sleep? Are you able to get your nutrition in? Or like, hey, you're coming back from this injury, and I just want to make sure you've done everything you can because you're such a vital part of this team. Should you go meet with this dietitian? Or, mm-hmm. you know, there's so many skills that we can use for performance. Don't you think it'd be helpful to go see a mental health specialist or a sports psychologist? And so you're tying it back to that you need them. You're tying it back to their role within the team. And then you're not trying to do it all. You're trying to get them to professionals that can help. For parents, I think it's always okay to challenge change in behaviors because you're the one that's seen it from day zero. Mm-hmm. So if all of a sudden they always love their particular lunches and dinners and they're like, oh no, I don't like that all of a sudden, and be like, well, when did that happen? How come? Like, why are you trying to avoid that? Or it seems like you're starting to change some of the foods that you're eating. Why, like, always leaning in with curiosity. I think as parents, and I'm a parent too, we have to watch coming in, like, hovering over and telling them what to do. Cause at that point they now have autonomy with their food choices. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to even more curl up in that shell and not be honest with you if they're struggling with their relationship with food and body.
Mm-hmm. No, I love that. And I think you're so right that the training that coaches receive, I think, is misdirected, because I'm sure that they do get training on what is an eating disorder and what is relative energy deficiency in sport. And that's one part of it, but then how can coaches actually use that information to be of use? You know, it's not useful if they know what it is, but don't actually have the confidence to apply it.
Well, I might disagree with you. I don't think they get education on what is an eating disorder and what is REDS, because in the literature, it'll say, like, first of all, if we do have coaches that are interested, it's usually young females. Mm-hmm. Some of our males and older males, and it could be just a choice of who does the research or not. But I know when I've done conferences, I've had coaches that come up to me and they're like, well, thank God I don't have any eating disorders. And I'm like,
like, what makes you, how do you know?
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm like, all right, you probably need to listen to this one again. Or again, we need to look at the time of season. I've coached before too, so I get it. Like, when you're in season, you're like mode, wow, player development, scouting, etc. And so that's hard for them to stop and think like health education. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be better. And the other thing that we've heard from coaches, and this kind of goes to what you said, they like to talk amongst peers. And so I think we need more like coach collaboration opportunities where they can talk through what they're experiencing their team. You got me going, so sorry if I'm rambling too fast.
No, this is great. I love it. I'm actually doing a research project on like coaches' confidence and intervening with eating disorders.
So yes,
I'm really interested in this, and I actually already started by just doing some background on like how many the state high school association websites where they put out like schedules and team rosters and stuff, and seeing how many of them mention eating disorders, relative energy deficiency in sport versus lightning strikes and cardiac conditions. And, you know, the list goes on and on of these really, really specific conditions versus eating disorders. And as I'm sure you know, and as you just pointed out, like there's a lack of information about eating disorders, and also like resources. Like there just aren't resources that are given to coaches of here's where you can go.
Yep. And on that note, and then I'll go back to the other one, is so I'm in Missouri, and in the state of Missouri, they only have to have physicals every 2 years. I've been doing this for a while now, and I've never had an athlete come to me that said, oh yeah, when I marked that I was struggling with my relationship with food, or I had a weight change, or I had a loss of period, they said, hey, we're still going to clear you to play, but you should probably go see somebody. Melissa Ritchie, I'm going to give her a shout out. She was an NP that was in one of my courses, and she actually did institute that in the state that she's in. And so she would bring the family members in and be like, you know, this isn't going to impact right now their clearance for play, but I just want to inform you that when you lose a menstrual cycle, you have an increased risk of a stress fracture. It can impact their health, their mental health. And at first, there was kickback that they were worried that parents were going to be upset that they were talking about that with their athletes. But actually, it was the opposite. The parents were so appreciative. They're like, oh, I wondered about that, but nobody brought that. I don't want her to get a stress fracture, or I don't want them to have to miss out on their sport. So she's on to something, and I hope we could get more medical providers to do that. But I'm with you. I'm with that game. Like, let's put the stuff on the websites and start implementing that. Now, going back to the cultures on a team, I wish I could take credit for this, but I can't. And that's okay, because it was an athlete of mine that I'd been working with. And it was her senior year in college. And the other captain had also struggled with an eating disorder. And they were basically like, something's got to give. You know, we're sick of this. We came up as a freshman where there was so much toxic culture around food talk, body talk. And so the two of them decided together that they were going to kind of implement table rules. Mm-hmm. That there was to be no talk about food. It would only be positive what they enjoyed, or encouraging others to get their recovery snacks, etc. They put intuitive eating rules up, principles up in the locker room. And then again, like what to say for like positive body affirmations. And so I'll be honest, at first I was like, oh, let's see how this team buys in. But over time, she said it was so great that actually they connected more over food, because they didn't have to worry about what was going to be said about what they were eating or their bodies. And just even the coaches started to like differ on how they approach the meal. So I think sometimes we can use captains, or we can use student ambassadors if the coaches aren't there yet, to make that change within their team, just like you're doing as well.
Yeah, I think that's such an amazing like idea, because I think teammates can have such a big impact on each other. And I know it's really difficult, because even my teammates will say comments like, you know, I need to run right now because I'm having this food later, or I can't have this food because we only ran this many miles. And they don't mean it in a harmful way, but, you know, it is triggering, and it does influence how then you exercise or how you eat. So I think it would be so like impactful to have that, those rules, and say like, no, this is like what we are going to say, and this is what we aren't. And about like the coaches, I'd love to know like how you approach coaches during your workshops who maybe aren't as responsive to, like you mentioned, admitting that there are eating disorders in sport and it is a problem. How would you talk to that coach to tell them like, underfueling is a really big issue in sports. Mm-hmm.
If I can get a sense of the vibe on the coach, sometimes I do a little bit of nice sarcasm. I'll be like, "Ooh, well, tell me what your secret is. Like, what are you doing to like how?" And so if they kind of look at you with a deer in the headlights, like, well, nothing, I'm like, okay, maybe there needs to be more education. But I always start with, look, I was an athlete. I still like to think I'm an athlete. A coach, I'm a parent of an athlete. So yeah, I want your athletes to perform well too, and they'll perform well when they're healthy. And mm-hmm. So let's talk about what your concerns are with making changes to nutrition. Cause I think a lot of coaches are always fearful that these kids are just going to go out and eat all crazy and then, end up getting sick before when they're running or not perform well, when really a lot of times it's the coach's own disordered eating that's showing up. And so that's why I'm always sensitive to it, that I don't ever want to come at it from a place of like, you just don't know what you're doing. They may not know any better because they've never challenged it themselves.
Yeah, no, I love that so much, especially I know I've seen this, that so many coaches right now grew up in a very toxic culture where like weigh-ins were a big thing, and like teams were very blatantly like, you know, don't eat, or like we have to like exercise a lot. So I think like that does rub off on athletes. And I think that's what's continuing this cycle.
Yep, I agree.
So to wrap things up a little bit, I'd just love to know if there's one takeaway that like an athlete or a listener can take away from this episode, what would it be?
It's always hard to come up with one, but I think I always come back to, don't you owe it to yourself to just give it a shot to make sure you're fed and then see how your performance. I feel like a lot of athletes have never gotten to a place of being well nourished and well rested. And it would be a shame to end your career and think, how could I perform better? I mean, that's kind of what sat with me with basketball. Like, I started out with good intentions, and then took it too far. And I finally had really great coaching. And I think, man, how good could I have been had I not been struggling with my nutrition during that time? So, you know, to avoid the red, you got to be fed.
Amazing. I think that's a great place to leave it.